stakeholders who made submissions on Wednesday, the media, you are welcome. And the meeting is officially open. The other members, we believe, will join us during the course of the meeting as they are stuck in traffic. Because people have got pressure of traveling today, going back home or to their respective destinations. Apologies, Secretary.
I also apologize on behalf of the Marathani and the Kosti Kiva.
I'm apologizing for Minister and Deputy Minister. They are at the Council of Economic Advisors President's meeting and also a bilateral with the Reserve Bank on the current economic crisis caused by coronavirus, so they could not be with us this morning.
Why did they choose this meeting?
Honorable Nkolo Abrahams, Sanele Nkomo, and Honorable Dikeledi Mahlangu. Stuck in traffic, they will join us any time from now. Let's move straight to item 3.
Honorable Vessels also asked to be excused today. He will be back next week.
Okay, thanks. We'll have Treasury responding on our allow PBO to make a few comments, and if ever the stakeholders are still here, also make a few comments. Then we discuss the committee, the report as a committee. Let me request the DG to lead on item 3, responses by National Treasury. Over to you.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, good morning. I'm with colleagues from the National Treasury. On my right, I'm with Buipuso Modise. She's the Chief Director responsible for modeling and forecast of the Treasury. On my left is Ian Stewart, Acting DDG, Pub Budget Office, and Christopher Exelsen, who is Chief Director in Tax and Financial Sector Policy. Chair, as this, agenda item suggests that we are responding to the public hearings, and second slide, we are pleased and to have had engagements with the submissions for public hearings that we have been made. We've got a number of organizations, and I'll quickly run through them. Action 24, Black Tobacco Farmers Association, British American Tobacco, South Africa Budget Justice Coalition, Congress of COSATU, FFC, Fiscal Cliff Study Group, Limpopo Tobacco Processors, National Council Against Smoking, National Union of Metal Workers South Africa, Parliamentary Budget Office, PwC Tech Services, Rural Health Advocacy Group Project, South African Tobacco Transformative Alliance, SAICA, Tobacco Control Advocacy Alliance, TWISP, Organization Undoing Tax Abuse, and Vapor Product Association. These are all the organizations that we interacted with, and the summary of the discussions are as follows in slide number 3. We're going to look at the appropriateness of the budget given the current economic environment. There's a debate whether it's, fiscal consolidation and stimulus debate. It has been with us for a while. And all of these, what are the implications for growth in terms of what this budget is all about? There's also focus largely on the wage bill and other baseline proposals and the implications thereof. And also then we look at tax proposals as they relate to additional revenue as well as tobacco products. That's essentially some of the main discussion points that we picked up and that we think we should engage on. Slide number 4. In terms of the budget 2020, as we have interacted with it and as we have seen it, the budget review is quite detailed in terms of the assumptions that we make and the approaches, and we have been having engagements on this before. We are proposing a tough budget because we are facing unsustainable fiscal outlook. And we think if it left unchecked, this could result in a major crisis. And the longer we wait, the larger the necessary future fiscal adjustments will need to be made in order to stabilize debt, because as we know, debt is not only stabilizing but also increasing at a higher, much higher level than we anticipated previously. Debt service costs will also continue to be the fastest growing area of expenditure, and this, as one can imagine, crowds out some expenditure, in particular social expenditure. In this budget, we see spending rising to 1.84 trillion this year, to about 2.14 trillion in 2022-23, and two categories remain to grow faster than inflation, and wage bill grows below inflation because of the interventions we made. The reductions that we made reflect lower growth in spending relative to baseline that we founded on more optimistic focus on revenue and growth in the past. And even without these changes, honourable members, the deficit is widening to 6.8, which is obviously worrying, and debt will rise to around 3.6 trillion. And if debt does not stabilise over the medium term, this budget that we're presenting begins to take the first steps towards establishing that debt stabilises at a number. So the point that we are making is that debt is worrying, and the more we rake in more debt, the more we are crowding out social expenditure, which is quite worrying, and we have to come up with measures that stabilises debt as we move forward. Slide number 5, in terms of the wage bill proposals, which are obviously an issue and a big point that must be considered. Before I even look at what we have put on the slide, I think it's important to recognize and note that it is not that we are not cutting wages. We are reducing the rate of increase for wages. So that's a point I think that we need to continuously make so that we find each other as to how we want to understand the wage bill proposals that are on the table. Page 3 of the budget review, we're saying that government recognizes that public service employees should be fairly remunerated, no doubt about it, and I think no one will contest that. But we are also obligated to balance compensation demands with the broader needs of society as reflected in the budget. So what we have to do, and what we're saying with the sentence essentially, is that it will continue to be a difficult balancing act, Chair, that we have to make in order to balance the needs, broader needs of society, broader needs of other categories of spending, vis-a-vis balancing that with the compensation that we make. And also recognizing that we have to pay people fairly, and also at some point engage on productivity, etc., in terms of what we're getting for the money that we're paying to employees in government. So it's important that we balance all of these things out. And I'll also indicate later in the proposal as to, on its own, the wage proposal will not hold. There are other things that we think we are putting on the table in this budget, and as part of the conversations we're having with labor to ensure that we address some of those things. So as I said, we are not proposing a reduction in nominal wages or reduction in headcount. That's we don't want. We don't want to contribute, as some people say, that if we retrench, obviously we contribute towards the number of people unemployed. The proposal, as I said, is just simply to reduce wage bill growth to below inflation. and that's what the submission we are making. Budget 22 makes provision for slower increase in the consolidated wage bill, which grows by 1.5% next year, 4.5% in the middle year, and 4.4% in the last financial year. And in some addition to this, by the way, as much as there are these increases, low as in the first year as it is, almost at inflation in the second and third year, we are providing some personal income tax relief in 2021. So as much as recognizing that they should be fairly remunerated employees of the state, these are some of the measures in that bullet number 2 that we're making, the point we're making, that we have provided some relief. And we give good details in some of the examples that we're talking about, and we did that in the speech by the minister. Over the past 12 years, public service wages have increased by 40% in real terms. In recent years, wage bill growth has outpaced the rest of the economy. And these are facts that cannot be disputed, and this is what we humbly putting on the table. And we're also saying that the current wage agreement has been more generous than envisaged because CPI has been revised down for this year and last year. Compensation bill reductions now can open the door for increased hiring of teachers, health workers and others in future. We also recognize that it's important to employ more teachers, it's important to employ more nurses, more doctors and more police officers. So we think all the savings that can be accrued, we need to focus on these other categories of expenditure on the wage front. We also have to, at the same level, combat wasteful expenditure and make spending more efficient. And we need to focus on these measures, and we call them fiscal leakages that are there, and I'm going to detail some of these later on in the presentation. Whatever we do, these changes obviously are not sufficient to close the deficit. So it therefore means a different conversation is necessary, and that conversation has got to do with growth and improving all those growth reforms that are critical to boost and the economy. Slower spending growth will have an impact on GDP, as we know, everything else being equal. This is reflected in the growth and revenue forecast used in the 2020 budget. An unsustainable fiscal outlook increases the cost of capital and lowers investment. The more we borrow, the more we have to pay in interest. And then we are squeezing out, as we said, certain categories of spending that are critical to service delivery, that are critical to keeping the rest of the economy functioning and the rest of government functioning. Higher interest rate makes investment more expensive for the whole economy, as I said, and thereby reducing potential GDP growth. This is also the case for government, where yields on our debt have risen despite a very accommodative international climate. So we are not taking advantage of this accommodative international climate because our debt and the yields on our debt have risen. The stimulus and austerity debate implies that South Africa is facing a short-term cyclical slowdown in growth. And government's view is that our growth problems are largely structural. We are not in any way in an austerity environment. If you have to look at Greece and what it meant, just as a recent case study in the last 10, 15 years or so, Greece had to go through at least 10 different iterations of austerity. And every time, you know, it was becoming harder and harder over the years that Greece has gone through. We are nowhere near there. We have not said we are cutting social grants by half. We are not there saying we are cutting employee salary by half. We are nowhere saying we are going to be ceasing to pay towards pension. We are nowhere, anywhere of those where austerity measures would really bring down the economy as it is. So all we are saying with the wage bill as an example, we are simply saying we are slowing the growth, at least in the first year to 1.5, in the second year to 4.5 and 4.4. So the argument that suggests that we are in, this budget is an austerity budget is not correct in terms of where we sit in our view. We have been running large deficits for the past 10 years. And GDP continues to decline. And that's the point I think that we must engage with, that last bullet. So it's important that we despite the large deficit, GDP growth continues to decline. And there are clear, this bullet is instructive in many ways in terms of how then we need to do things differently in order for us to grow as an economy. The reforms are critical, and in slide number 7 and in the budget review, we'll go into some detail in looking at some of these, including obviously how we lower the cost of doing business, which is quite important. On the electricity fund, there are reforms that the Minister of Energy, Minister of and Minister of Finance and President outlined in various fora. And we think this is the point, you know, in the right direction, and we have to accelerate some of the reforms that are critical in this area. Secondly, in the ports, We, Minister did indicate, give an example about the Devon port and what we need to be doing there and many other interventions that are needed in this area. As an example, how do you corporatize National Ports Authority? On the rail front, clearly the economic regulation of transport bill clearly has got in it, again, you know, spells out critical things that are necessary in unlocking the growth potential that this brings. Telecom, same there, around accelerating digital migration and continue in earnest to work on the release of spectrum, one way or the other. We have to enforce open access conditions and ensure rapid deployment guidelines. This is quite critical, and we continue to engage with the telcos, you know, various, you know, whether it's Telcom, whether it's MTN, you know, Vodacom, and Cell C. We need to continue engaging with them, and because where they sit, clearly there's need for them to have access to the much needed spectrum, and in order for their own offerings to improve, which ultimately will have the impact in lowering costs and data costs. So this is quite an important area. This budget also, what it does, it's supporting small business, because clearly if we improve this area, the conditions ease, support, recognize that startups are critical, we think that this can be another area where growth can be enhanced. We will obviously look at what the Competition Commission says about retail and telecoms ease of doing business project. I mean, you know, if the BizHub portal is working. I was reading some reviews yesterday around people who have accessed this and who it literally open a business within a few hours, register for tax, open a bank account, and you can. So this is and we hope we will do well in terms of the surveys, future surveys on the ease of doing business in South Africa, which has got a potential in it of attracting investments, because people will see the ease of doing business can really be enhanced in the country. There are sectoral master plans that the Department of Trade, Industry and Investments is pushing from all sectors. So these are all, they are there, focused, and it's going to be quite important as part of this budget process and the finalization of the appropriation process, that departments and various sectors come through and engage with Parliament one way or the other in terms of what those plans are that will boost employment and investment. So we know them, they are there, we've engaged, we've refined them jointly in various clusters in government, and we think once implemented, we should be able to actually see the benefits. There are reductions in spending baselines that we have instituted to a total of about 100 billion. In page 26 of the budget review, we are saying that it's important that to achieve fiscal sustainability, what's required is for public spending levels to be closely aligned with the revenue-raising potential of the economy. And I think, again, it's that balancing act that I was talking about, that even if you are actually cutting or easing or slowing down the rate of increase in some category of spending, that you do that in a responsible way where the impact is not felt in a big, big way. In this budget review that you've outlined, we're setting out the implications of spending reductions on other areas of spending, which may include slower rollout of programs that potentially has a negative impact on maintenance and increased accruals. Cost pressures have been funded through a combination of reallocation and reprioritization over the MTF, and we'll continue doing that. We continue looking at this budget, the allocations that have been made before, whether they are efficient in terms of spend, whether those programs are necessary, or whether some should be closed down. What we have been doing the last few years is to essentially do that, close down, scale back, scale down some of the programs, including those programs and budgets that have been underspending, and refocusing those to cost pressures that are urgent and that have got direct impact on the poor, and especially where service delivery is lacking. So we'll continue doing that, especially in an economy that's not growing. The space to just do a cut across all programs and reduce across the board has become very limited over the years. I normally say to various, you know, and in our various engagements that when we started with the cost reduction measures in 11-12 financial year, 12-13 financial year, when the former then Minister of Finance, Mr. Pravin Gordhan, he was talking about the haircuts and kept on saying we are cutting, and that is, we have closed that, you know, we've done a lot in that area, especially on goods and services, but we'll continue doing that. But it's important that we protect the spending items that have got direct impact on the service device assets. We will undertake with the Department of Performance Monitoring and Evaluation, undertake new rounds of expenditure reviews to identify cost savings and improve efficiencies. I always say it's important to squeeze efficiencies out of the system, where you enforce and you dictate and you want to make sure that when necessary you cut wasteful and fruitless expenditure. And we have to continue doing that. Now let's look at some broad spending growth, average spending growth over the medium, looking at economic classification. If you look at the interest and rent on land, assuming that inflation is 4.4, 11.8, capital payments account for 9.6, current transfer 6.1, and look at compensation, and I did indicate at the beginning why is it low, and which is for reasons that we've outlined, that consolidated wage bill is projected to grow at an annual average growth of 3.5% over the medium term. So there's no cut, just dealing with the wage bill debate and argument. Current transfers and capital payments continue to grow faster than CPI inflation, and obviously those are, you know, it's on average, including equitable share transfers and conditional grant transfers, and we'll go in some details later on. Average spending growth over the medium-term expenditure framework, this is worrying. The debt service costs continue to outpace all by almost double in terms of average annual growth over the 3 years, 12.3%, and we think that should actually be scaled back in order for us to unlock certain areas where growth should be enhanced. Look at peace security. That's where your police, your defense is, and parts of home affairs. So it's important that we change this picture, and it's worrying. And that's where I said that if we unlock certain, if we unlock value that's currently locked in what we spend in debt service costs, we are able to actually, employ more police officers, more nurses, and more doctors, as I said. Slide number 11, transfers to fund operational costs of social service in province and free basic services in municipalities have been protected in real terms and real per capita terms. Now, despite all of these changes, when you go deeper into the budget and analyze it further, that statement that's bold becomes, you know, relevant and it's in your face type of, because we'll continue doing that. But if the growth in real terms, real per capita, is declining to levels that are unsustainable, it therefore means there's negative, you know, direct negative impact of the impact in communities that we are attempting to serve. Majority of the budget remains so for social services, which is a plus factor. Operational budget funded through equitable share allocations increased to compensate for growing populations. Reductions to conditional grants are focused on areas where funds are not being fully spent, and I think I must emphasize that, or where there's inefficiency in spending, or where projects are delayed for various reasons. So we are still in that environment where budgets are there. The only cut is we're not cutting, we're not in an austere environment where we even cut when programs are working because we are trying to save something that essentially can destroy our economy. We are only at this point in time focusing on those grants, some of them where they're not being fully spent or there's inefficiencies. Transferring national departments and provinces and municipalities are accountable for performance of individual grants. And this is, I think, something that we would request that as Parliament approaches engaging with this budget, including its implementation, that we appropriate accountability where it belongs. We, at our level, as Treasury, we obviously will be available to support with data and facts and what you pick up. But accounting officers, both transferring national departments and provinces, should be responsible for the performance of individual grants because they are there. On the Health Financing Fund, National Department of Health and National Treasury will review health conditional grants to ensure alignment to NHI and improve delivery. And that, I think, is important as NHI has been rolled out and we support that. Development components to assist rural provinces added in 2 grants in 2020, and I think it's important that we added that. And again, we should be looking out in terms of the spending thereof. And we continue to review the equitable share to examine exactly what is costing us in delivering services, especially to the poor areas. Now, I did say something earlier about balancing the demand on workers in terms of them agreeing to a level of, you know, wage growth that is increasing. We also have to do these things that are outlined in slide number 12, and I'll quickly just go into detail with some of them. Procurement reforms are critical because there's inefficiency, and we are the first people to acknowledge that across the state, whether you look at municipalities, province, and national departments. And we think the draft procurement bill that, you know, will give, you know, Cabinet has allowed us to issue it for public comment, and we've done that, and it will come through here in Parliament through the normal processes. And I think we'll have to, we aim at improving procurement reform because of the wastage that's currently there. And we have to approach this very carefully because you don't want also to relax certain controls that are critical and necessary in a procurement environment. Subnational reforms are also important. We continue making sure that we reduce unfunded budgets, municipal budgets, in ensuring that the budgets that municipalities pass are funded and that we don't have to have an issue with that. Claims against the state, medical legal claims are out of control and we need to control that spend. Tax incentives, we'll have to continue conducting a review on incentives, their implications and their importance, and repeal and or redesign those that are redundant, and I guess there are many, and those that are also inefficient and inequitable. So we have to revisit, and we will revisit, this tax incentive environment. Public sector remuneration, we will, and we have to. It's only, time is June, time is now for us to publish a new law, and obviously will come through Parliament, that introduced a new framework for public entities of state-owned companies. It doesn't make sense that, and I'm not going to even try and use any entity as an example, but you find in some cases that small entities, public entities, for the fact that they are outside government, the remuneration levels are out of control, way above, the average in the public sector, including way above what even the president earns or a DG earns. It's uncalled for. We are bailing out state-owned companies. They continue to pay high remuneration levels, and they also continue to pay bonuses. It cannot be. So we have to balance that out, still retain the skills, and still be able to remunerate people fairly, but also we have to take cognizance of the fact that if public sector, government and public servants are taking the pain of getting a less than expected increase, which is above which is inflation, or just the rate is increasing a little bit by 1.5%. We also have to visit this area where public entities' salary levels will have to be reviewed. So we think by coming up with this law remuneration framework, it will make it easy so that the expectations are very clear. Currently, we know in government, we know how much a chief director earns. We know the maximum of what a DG can earn, etc. That's certainty. But in this case, state-owned companies and public entities, it's free for all, and board remuneration also becomes an issue there. So we'll come back to Parliament on these measures that you're proposing that will improve spending and reduce waste. as we all know that by now the president mentioned this, the minister mentioned this, there will be no increase in salaries for public office bearers in 2021, and this follows a reduction in benefits stemming from changes to the ministerial handbook. So again, that's an area that we're putting on the table, so that it's not only public servants who have to bear the brunt. Other costs will need to be controlled over the medium term or in the coming year. We'll report on the cost of unauthorized and wasteful expenditure and examine ways to reduce state litigation, accommodation and information technology costs. Classic example that you know around accommodation, you find that in the same city center, whether it's Tswane, Joburg or Cape Town, anywhere in the country, you find that government pays different rates. With my colleagues yesterday in the Treasury, I was saying it cannot be that we have to sign a lease of 9 years, 11 months, because if it's 10 years, you avoid certain, it can't be. So we have to look into the accommodation leases, engage with leasing companies, where possible renegotiate the price that you pay per square meter, and let it be fair, both for them and for the state. Because some of these buildings are going to have long-term leases, or if not for a very, very long time. Same with information technology here. We have to relook at that environment. CETA is a custodian of, acquiring the ICT of government. But the example has always been that you can go to Incredible Connection, get a computer for 10,000 rand or 5,000 rand, but if you buy through CETA, then you have to pay 30,000, 25,000. It cannot be. So these are the costs that I think we have to bring them down. And make it difficult for ourselves. Some of the examples is what you know, Minister, in terms of the ministerial handbook, business class travel here and there, review, and I've been saying it, and this has been discussed in various fora, that if you look at, for instance, ministers and the ministerial handbook, and look at the houses in Cape Town, as an example, we are all here. Some of these, it's unnecessary in the way we spend. You find that in some cases, there's a huge house that a minister lives in, and these are the debates and discussions that we had, and that the ministerial handbooks will attempt to correct as time goes on. That maybe a single minister with no family, if they have to stay in an apartment, why not? If we have to scale down on what we own and what we pay. So these are conversations, and they are being handled carefully, and they are being welcomed, by the way, and we think we are able to deal with these things and balance again that with the demand that we are putting on public servants, because it cannot be that opulence continues. And that's why I think we've demonstrated, Minister of Finance and other ministers, including the President, they've shown restraint in these areas. Delegations going overseas will be cut, etc., etc. So there's a number of issues that we put on the table that government is committed to doing, and we are doing, by the way. And obviously, Cabinet expects us to report to them on these measures. Now, I will stop there and ask Chris Axelsen, because if I pretend to be a tax expert, I'll get it wrong. So Chris will start talking to us from slide number 13. And right up to the end, and deal with all the measures that has to do with tax, and why we decided not to increase taxes, why we decided not to increase VAT, but instead give some relief to some categories of spending of employees, because we thought that's important. And whilst we dealt with some excise and duties. Thanks. With your permission, Chief.
Thanks, DG. Good morning, members. So just on the tax side, just to set a bit of context, we've had 5 years of quite large tax increases, and we've been putting through a lot of measures to raise additional revenue. However, unfortunately, the shortfalls that we've seen on the revenue side have just been getting consistently larger from year to year, and this really does create quite a bit of havoc with our fiscal framework and our planning. This year, we decided not to raise additional tax revenue, with the primary reason being the weakness in the economy. In budget 2019, we had even penciled in an additional 10 billion rand. We had thought growth for the year was going to be 1.5%. It's actually come out at 0.3%, which is a lot lower, and it's actually come out to 0.2 actual from StatsSA. And because of that reason, we thought we can't put large additional tax increases through the budget at this stage. It could have pushed us even into a recessionary environment, even though we are there already. So we were going to get additional revenue from the carbon tax, which had already been introduced, and we had an increase in the plastic bag levy, and we used that additional revenue to provide a small amount of relief to personal income taxpayers so we could increase the bracket by more than inflation. So some of the comments that we've received, and we've gone through all the comments in detail on all the submissions, were saying, we're welcoming the fact that there was not a tax increase after quite a few years of tax increases. They did welcome it, but then they did say, well, this is a realization from government that the tax to GDP is too high, as well as a recognition of the principle that we can't raise any additional taxes because we won't get any additional money. You know, we just wanted to say those weren't the actual reasons why we didn't raise taxes. We're not saying that the tax to GDP is too high. We're saying that the weak economy in this business cycle, large increases in taxes would have really been detrimental to growth. So there could still be scope for tax increase later on if required. It is worth noting that debt to GDP doesn't stabilize in the medium term at the moment, and we still need to have other options to see what we can do to stabilize debt to GDP. The other point is that this is, you know, government recognizing that they can't raise additional revenue. We also don't agree with that. You know, we do think we could raise additional revenue if required. If you look at some of the measures that we put in the last 5 years, even though the shortfalls have been very large, they would have been even larger. We would have had even less revenue if we didn't put in measures. So that was on the one side. On the other side of the comments, they were saying that we should have increased taxes. We should have had much larger tax increases. Some of them were saying we shouldn't have provided any personal income tax relief, and we should have actually increased VAT to try and sort out the fiscal position. Other commentators were saying we should have increased the corporate income tax rates, and we should have increased taxes on the wealthy. You know, as before, you know, we didn't think that was a good approach in this environment. You know, we wanted to let the economy try and recover from this recession that it's currently in. On the corporate income tax side, we've also been quite explicit that we are looking to broaden the base on the corporate income tax side. So we've put in additional measures in the budget, such as limiting the amount of interest that multinationals can deduct in order to combat base erosion and profit shifting, as well as limiting the amount of carried forward assessed losses you can use to reduce your taxable income. Both of those measures should bring in additional revenue, and we've been quite clear in the budget that actually what we want to do is to try and reduce the corporate income tax rate in the future by restructuring the regime to make it more competitive, but by doing it in a revenue-neutral way, so not providing any additional funds to corporates, but just restructuring it in a revenue-neutral way that's more competitive. Some of the commentators also said that we shouldn't stick to the 25% tax to GDP ratio. I think there's an idea that government has this limit of 25% tax to GDP. We just wanted to say that, you know, we don't have that as a policy mechanism at the moment. The tax to GDP is already above 25, it's at 26.2, and it's not a factor that we use in our tax policy decision making. On excise duty increases on tobacco, government follows a policy guideline where we try to provide certainty to industry to say that we target an excise duty burden that is 40% of the retail selling price of the most popular brands of cigarettes. At the moment, after quite a few years of above inflation increases, the actual excise duty burden on cigarettes is higher than that 40%. But we've had some commentators saying, mostly from the tobacco industry, saying we didn't want any increase in tobacco excise duties. So we had a lot of submissions saying it's above the excise duty burden, you shouldn't have increased excise duty on tobacco at all. We've had other commentators on the other side, mostly NGOs, saying there should be a far higher increase than the 4.4% increase that we provided for. And there is serious tobacco harm on individuals, and it leads to direct health costs, and those in effect are being subsidized by the taxpayer. So So we had two different, very different sides on this argument. We've recognized that we are above the excise duty burden, and I just want to say that this guideline is a guideline. It's not legislated that it needs to be at 40% of the price of the most popular brand. It's a guideline. So there is still discretion from the Minister of Finance in terms of what changes he can make. And in previous years, he has gone above inflation in order to generate additional revenue to help with fiscal consolidation. And we realize we are slightly above, but it's not dramatically above. A lot of those, that measure, the 40% of the price of the packet, is actually influenced by the pricing behavior of industry. So if industry don't increase the prices, then the tax burden goes a lot higher. So it's quite a difficult one to try and target. We have said previously in discussion papers that we've put out that we would always look at either a minimum of a CPI increase or a higher increase in order to get towards the excise duty burden. So for this budget, we're comfortable with the higher value, and we went for normal then an increase in line with inflation. We've also had quite a lot of support for the new tax on heated tobacco products, which was implemented on the day of the budget. We also announced that we will tax e-cigarettes, which is slightly different. There's no tobacco in e-cigarettes, but there could be nicotine and the chemicals that they use. We're going to hold a workshop on that within the next couple of weeks to try and determine the details so that it can start to be taxed in 2021. But we really do need complementary measures as well to try and reduce the harm. We need increases in enforcement, so we're trying to work with SARS and pushing SARS to assist there. There has been quite a big increase in the excise duty revenues on tobacco in this last year, so it does look as if some of the enforcement measures are starting to work. But we also need other complementary measures to try and reduce harm, especially vaping in schools. We have a few comments to say that our tax system is not progressive enough. We think it is quite progressive. We think more could be done to make it more progressive, but we just wanted to say that we have done quite a lot of measures in the past few years to improve the progressivity of the system. We've had a 1 percentage point increase in the rates for all the income tax brackets, except for the bottom bracket, which really made it a lot more progressive. We had a new top tax bracket of 45% above $1.5 million. We've had a higher dividends tax rate. We increased it from 15 to 20%, which is a big increase, and a lot of the higher income individuals get dividends through that way. And we had an increase in the capital gains inclusion rate over the past 2 years. So all those measures have helped with progressivity. If you look at that chart on slide 15, that's from the World Bank. It's basically showing, if you look at the orange dot in that chart, it's showing the proportion of tax revenues that those countries get from personal income tax. We have quite a high proportion. It's even higher compared to OECD countries in terms of how much we receive from personal income tax. But the other very notable thing is that only the top four deciles pay personal income tax. So we've increased the tax-free threshold, which means that the vast majority, you know, more than 60% of individuals in the country don't pay personal income tax. So it really is skewed towards those on higher incomes. And as you can see from that chart, the large blue bar, most of the revenue is paid by those in the top decile compared to other countries at a similar level of development. And that's from the World Bank. I've got the source in there. But we do recognize, and some of the comments were very useful to say, but there are all these exemptions in the system, and those exemptions undermine progressivity and incentives. And we agree with that. And we've also written it in the book. You know, we really want to review these incentives, review these exemptions, to say what can we get rid of to improve progressivity, which will also raise additional revenue that we need for social expenditure. Other comments that we received, just a general one, is that the tax system is primarily to raise revenue, but we're happy to use it also for health and environmental objectives. So the other comments were that the carbon tax rate should be much higher and the allowances curtailed. So we've had a long discussion in Parliament on that. And we do have a CPI plus 2 percentage point increase in the legislation. So that's already, there's no discretion on the minister there. There's a higher than inflationary increase in the rate in the legislation. By the second phase of the carbon tax in 2023, we will then review the design to see how effective it is, and then we will look at all the allowances and see whether they need to be curtailed or not to try and reduce emissions. From other comments, there was quite a bit of support on the tax for single-use plastics. We need to do workshops on that to determine how exactly we design the tax and with how SARS can administer it. There have been calls to use revenue from this and the plastic bag levy for to support recycling, and we're trying to work with the Department of Environment, Forestry and Fisheries on seeing what solutions they can put in to improve recycling in the sector and to help with the circular economy. There were questions on what is the progress on the export tax on scrap metal. We've announced that we've put it in with the rates on scrap metal in Chapter 4 in the budget, that we will immediately consult over the introduction of the export duty for ferrous, aluminium and copper. There will also be a workshop within the next couple of weeks on that to consult on it immediately, and then we can put it into the tax legislation and bring it through to the committee to discuss with the committee and try and get this passed. This is a new tax, so there's only a diamond export levy in the system, which has its own bill, but this is a new tax, and we need to go through the legislative process with Parliament on this. I also note that there weren't very many comments on this, but it's also just worth noting that there were quite significant changes made on financial surveillance by moving to a new capital flows management framework. So this is going to improve oversight of flows and make it easier for individuals to retain their ties. And also just to note that we did have a NEDLAC agreement on retirement reform proposals, which was mentioned in Annexure E of the budget. I think that covers everything, DG.
Thank you, Jed. Just in terms of the point about the export tax, we even have a date for consultation, which is the 12th of March, from 11 to 1, as part of the consultations that we will be starting on this.
Okay, thanks, TJ and your team. Let me request the PBO, FFC, they are not here. Okay, PBO, make a short comment so that we can move to...
Thank you very much, Chair, for the opportunity. We also want to thank National Treasury for this kind of engagement. And we thank the committee, particularly when we did with FFC, the budget analysis presentation on Tuesday, there was definitely an appetite and discussion by honourable members to look at the effectiveness of the engagement process and the oversight and influence over the the budget. And I want to thank Treasury for their responses and the comprehensiveness of their responses, especially with regard to expenditure and taxation and those kinds of things. I'm going to keep my comments to the broader big picture macro issues, as I feel that these have come up time and again, and to some extent I think we may be speaking past each other rather than to each other, and to use this kind of forum for that discussion. To start with, we see words like unsustainable, moving towards balancing the budget, even discussions about is it austerity or not coming up without, I think, adequate definition. And also to say that you can have a broad academic definition, you can have a technical definition, but you also need a definition that fits into your specific context. And that needs to be clarified more. When we say increasing the debt would be unsustainable given this environment, is that true? Or would that actually be something that you do when you're running into repeated recessions? So we need to think about that, and we've been saying the same thing since 2013, and things have just been getting worse. And so we've been saying we can't increase the debt, and we see the debt to GDP level going down, and in fact there's been an acknowledgement over the years that fiscal consolidation has been a drag on GDP. And we don't know the extent to which it's been a drag, but that means that the denominator of the debt-to-GDP ratio has been affected, and therefore that ratio has gone up. Now, I want to say this without being facetious, but you know, 150 years ago, it was common to have bloodletting by doctors. It was the mainstream. They used leeches and they cut people and they bled people, and that was often the way you dealt with sicknesses. Thinking has changed. We've moved on. Technology has improved. The medical profession has improved, and I think we also in our macroeconomic thought, we need to think about are the things that we're doing the right things because they're mainstream and because they're widespread in use. Does that mean they're the right thing? And I think in the international debate, we're seeing more and more questioning of that. And I raise this in the context of our discussion that, you know, a lot of the problems in the economy have been demand-side problems, but the issues addressed in the budget reviews and in the past and in the current one have been about the supply side. And seeing things from a supply-side economics approach. And I think we would like to see more engagement with different ways of thinking about the economics, but also to recognize that this is, in the short term, but also in the long term, a demand-side problem. The response by the National Treasury says that this is a structural economic problem that can't be dealt with through short-term demand-side issues. And that, I think, is very much open to question. And then that raises the issue of, is it possible to stimulate the economy in the short term? Is it possible in a hierarchy of choices that you make in terms of cutting, being more effective with expenditure, cutting expenditure, etc., to the point where at some point you say, well, maybe I need to borrow and to spend in a targeted way. Now the question about structural problems and this approach towards sectoral reforms, I think one of the big things we raised last year when the National Treasury's paper was released was that was that one is that there's not enough focus again on the demand side, but two is, do these reforms address the structural problems in the economy? So just by reducing the cost of business, are you actually going to help with structural transformation in the economy? Now, you can reduce the cost of business for everybody, and you can perpetuate the structural problems because the stronger ones and the ones that have managed through the development of a certain growth path, especially in a constrained growth environment, have grown and become stronger, but also because we have a very concentrated economy. So we need to actually then open that discussion as well. The last two things I want to raise. The one is, I see the word crowding out. More government debt is going to be crowding out. And I, one of the things that has come up in the new mainstream consensus around fiscal policy, and the fact is that people are now more willing to discuss and use fiscal policy globally, is a recognition that the state can crowd in investment by spending. In some situations, people like Paul Krugman and others have used the term spend your way out of a depression or a recession, and also in that way get the economy going and crowd in private sector investment. And so we need to, I think, engage more and think more about that kind of term. The last thing I want to talk about, specifically linked to that kind of point, is the quote that was made again today from the 2020 budget review. To paraphrase, public expenditure must be closely aligned to revenue earning capability. Now, is that true in a cyclical, counter-cyclical, when you have counter-cyclical policies or you want to respond to poor growth, whether it's short-term recessions or whether it's long-term structural problems? And what should the state do, especially if it wants to go for real structural transformation, not just reducing the cost of doing business? So I'll end there and hand over to my colleague concerned.
Thank you. Good morning, honourable members. Good morning, colleagues. I think you covered quite a lot of ground, Siraj. The point I wanted to just emphasize is on the slide 6, which points back to fiscal policy objectives and assumptions. I think what we've tried to emphasize, Chair, is the risk around some of the risk around, you know, realizing the fiscal objectives that we've set ourselves since 2013. And now we see more risks now with, you know, some of the negotiations have not been finalized. There's still some of the expenditure reviews that need to take place. But I think the issue of slow spending on infrastructure, and lastly, the issue of capacity of various state entities and institutions to actually implement and monitor some of the programs that set out. There hasn't been a very specific response to those points. But I think the two points that I want to raise on revenue side from tax side, I mean, during our pre-brief and even post-brief, we've raised a point around taxation around digital economy. And I think the commissioner responded to some of the comments during the brief by the minister. But I think the point that we raised there, the commissioner indicated that government is working within the OECD framework to realize some of the multilateral approach to some of the issues there. But I think what we've seen and what we've also emphasized is how much that approach has already been discredited before it's been completed, and we've seen more countries trying to respond to the concerns by the systems to say, look, rather try to think within the some of the unilateral mechanisms and how far that could be effective. I think that's an area where you could still realize more revenue in that regard. But I think the approach that's been taken by many other countries has been more unilateral. Of course, there are concerns around corporations and so on. But I think that point has not been raised, commented on. So as colleagues will try to comment on that. What has been some of the thinking around unilateral approach on digital taxations, given that even some of the members of OECD themselves have actually departed from that, or are showing signs of diverging from the multilateral approach, but focus largely on unilateral. The last point is on corporate taxation, I think it's quite clear that there's been concerns how to structure that. But I think 2017, we've raised a comment around effective tax rate versus the statutory tax rate. We never followed through on discussion. We're meant to follow through on discussion, but I mean, now that Treasury is thinking, about reforming the corporate tax system, it would be interesting to get their view on, effective tax rate versus the corporate tax rate. More so that there's a perception that, we have high tax rate in corporate tax rate in South Africa, but in effect, we have some of the lowest effective tax rate when you compare to some of the countries that we often get compared to, in a sense that is that meaning effective tax rate to your statutory tax rate when you're thinking about restructuring the corporate tax system? Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thanks, PBO. We have stakeholders who made submissions written and oral on Tuesday so that they can raise questions and make comments before we move to members asking questions and making comments. Secretary, do we have stakeholders here?
The professor is the IC, and there's somebody at the back.
Okay. You will introduce yourself and then ask questions.
Thanks, Chairperson. My name is Matt Johnston. I'm from the organization Undoing Tax Abuse. We found that National Treasury made a response to a lot of what we said, but we didn't see an indication on how savings are going to be transferred to state-owned entities. So there was a statement made that the savings should be shifted to spending on infrastructure in health and education, but we don't see that so much in this budget. We see that most of the savings, or a big portion of it, is going to go to Eskom and SAA. and these are financially failing state-owned entities. We'd just like to understand how that's going to be dealt with and how the special appropriations bill is being dealt with in terms of conditional allocations like this. That's all from my side. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Otto. Any other input or professor?
Thank you, Chairperson. From the side of the Fiscal Cliff Study Group, we would like to hear the Treasury's comments on the fact that South Africa's fiscal cliff barometer deteriorates even further, despite the fact that the cap is paid on the civil service wage bill. The fiscal cliff barometer is calculated as the total of civil service remuneration plus interest on government debt plus social grant expenditure. These three items was equal to 55% of government tax revenue in 2008, and in this budget, despite the cap put on the growth in civil service remuneration, already accounts is equal to 75% of government revenue. So it's a very big increase over the past decade, and it keeps on increasing. We'd like to hear the Treasury's view on this looming fiscal cliff that South Africa faces and the continued deterioration that we see in this trend. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Prof. Any other question and input? It looks like we have time. Treasurer?
Thank you, Chair. I've got colleagues Ian and Wipuso. We will start with the first questions from the Parliamentary Budget Office, just from a very high level. Because we you know, yeah, maybe let me give Wipuso opportunity.
Thank you, members. So there we go. Thank you. So thank you very much for the comments from the PBO. Thank you for the reflections on the macro issues. If I've understood you correctly, the view is that there is more to be said about the thinking around whether or not this is the right time to be consolidating fiscal spending as opposed to expanding it, if that's my understanding, and sort of the nature of the expansion. So, I mean, I think it's very much dependent on how you view the challenge. I think from a macroeconomic standpoint, it could be argued that fiscal policy, particularly on the wage side, in relation to what you're seeing in the private sector, has been expansionary. But we're also not seeing very strong growth rates to support it. So the question is, what is it about the way that we're spending that's not giving us the kind of outcomes that we see, that we want to see for sustained growth? I think part of the answer lies in the composition of expenditure and what it is that we're buying with that money. I think in the same context, we have to consider what's been happening to total factor productivity over time. So even if we were to stimulate the economy and get it to a level of potential, where we think potential is, what we're seeing is, given what's happening to capital stocks, given what's happening to total factor productivity, potential growth is coming down over time. So short-term responses to try and get us to potential won't necessarily get us to the kind of growth that we need to see, a more inclusive and sustainable growth that would get us out of some of the socioeconomic challenges that the country faces. I do think that there's something to be said for more engagement, but I think that it needs to be framed in the context of what we are seeing as the structural issues and impediments to growth. So while I take the points, I think that there is something to be said about the nuance of how we spend, what sustainable stimulus looks like, and how it results in some of the outcomes that you are suggesting.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks for the comments. I'm just going to touch on two things. The comment about what does it mean in this environment to say that spending should be aligned with the revenue generating potential of the economy. I think to simplify it, our spending as a share of GDP is going to be 36% next year. And our revenue, despite repeated large tax increases, and we make this point that the majority of consolidation efforts have fallen on revenue rather than expenditure over the past 5 to 6 years. Even after all of those increases, we expect revenue to be around 28 or 29% of GDP, which implies, in effect, a deficit of 7 percentage points of GDP. Now, one can discuss how much of this is cyclical versus structural, but it is clear to us that there is a major structural deficit. The majority or a large proportion of that is structural. And fundamentally, we are saying that those numbers need to be more closely aligned if we're ever going to hope to stop the increase in debt to GDP, and that's kind of pretty basic arithmetic in this case. So, you know, our view is even if you take account of all of these measures, we still have a very large structural deficit that needs to be addressed. I hear the point about changing our thinking and so on, but I want to go back to the key point in the presentation that says we've been running deficits now since 2009-10, substantial deficits. Spending has continued to grow in real terms, and growth has come down over time. And for us, that is the strongest piece of evidence to suggest that government spending is not going to get us out of our current low growth trap. And despite all of this, and yes, these are substantial revisions that we're proposing on the wage bill growth, we are still allowing the deficit to widen again next year and for debt to rise substantially. So this budget, again, tries to balance between concerns about trying to close a deficit too quickly and more fundamental concerns about the structural constraints that underpin the slowdown in GDP growth. And our view is these structural reforms on electricity, ports, rail, telecoms, and industrial policy are far more important than allowing the deficit to widen again in the coming year. And that is at the heart of the trade-offs that are shown in the budget 2020.
Before Chris comes in on the text, I think it's important to note and realize that what we are saying here is part just broadly the responses. But if you go to the book itself, we are saying it's important that we address the inefficiencies around state-owned companies. SAA, for instance, if you look at the allocations, that 16 point whatever billion that you're putting there, is to repay debt. So it's guaranteed debt. If we don't pay, then obviously, you know, guaranteed debt. We, you know, it's conditional. We granted these guarantees. That it's not working, so we have to repay. But we are saying, you know, do you repay and look the other side? No. I think broadly we are saying the whole state-owned company environment is a problem. The whole state-owned company environment needs to be looked at. We have to squeeze efficiencies out and individually go to each entity and deal with whether it's Denel, SABC, SAA, SA Express, etc. And with it, obviously, the business rescue proposal, when it's finalized, the plan, when it's finalized, you know, we'll interact with it and see. And then government will have to take a decision as to what exactly happens there. The ESCOM story is a bit different in terms of having previously recognized that we need to support ESCOM, $23 billion per year, special appropriation bill that gives ESCOM 56, 40, you know, 33 and 23, the arguments, and we tabled that last year. The conditions, I think we cannot not emphasize and implement. We have our weekly meetings with them, where our teams continue to ensure that these are achieved. We work closely with Andre as soon as he started there, and we are comfortable that it steps in the right direction in terms of squeezing efficiencies that are needed and forcing certain things. Same, by the way, and we may not mention it in detail in there in terms of the work that we do. Same with the SABC. If you remember, the amount we gave to the SABC, we said at the time that, you know, there are 14 conditions, a three-page letter I wrote to them. Again, we are monitoring all of those. So it doesn't mean when it's not here, it's not happening. But in a different conversation, obviously, we can look at the actual nitty-gritty of what we are doing in these entities. So what you're mentioning is important. We cannot ensure that we continue to save, continue to actually get the entities to be more efficient. So there are conditions that are set in the special appropriation, and we have to continue putting the pedal on those. And Ian, maybe you want to go back to the fiscal cliff story, just in a very direct way again. But we'll get to it now. But the point I think that Wipuso is making, we recognize, I mean, structural reforms, again, in this presentation and in this budget, you cannot look in isolation towards an economic transformation paper that we issued last year and look at it in isolation of the budget. We are saying that in that paper, which has become obviously a blueprint of items that should be in the radar screen that are not contested, because we are saying no, only for now network industries are critical, and we are only choosing a few, those that I've mentioned. But how fundamental they are vis-a-vis demand side, short-term demand side interventions, fusing the two, obviously you'll get some contradiction, and that's what I think you are putting out. And then we'll want to obviously engage the PBO further on how then, because currently you cannot not implement some of the critical structural reforms that are necessary. Whether you look at those that we've listed, including talking about competition and how competition and how monopolies have dominated the South African economy, and how to actually approach it differently. So because there are those kind of interventions that are critical that are mentioned in the paper. So we will obviously want to engage the PBO further on this matter, in particular, you know, structural issues that are long-term in nature vis-a-vis demand-side short-term interventions, and how to balance those in a way that recognizes that the long-term demand-side problem, I mean, you know, and how we deal with it. So one takes into account clearly, and then the fact that we're making that fiscal consolidation has been a drag to GDP. So we'll have to help each other understand so that we find each other. And we know you've been raising this, but how the challenge has always been when you have targeted certain assumptions in targeting your revenue, then the performance is not small by small amounts. In the past, we know we used to deal with 10, 15 billion, but now in the last few years, under collection, dealing with 50, 60, 70 billion rand in 1 year. So it's very difficult to really balance this thing out. And in the short term, what you then force, it's like your fiscal consolidation is out of the window, because then your debt increases. So, yes, balancing debt increasing debt, and balancing interventions that are needed, and the argument that you're putting on the table that we are not in an austerity environment, and what does it mean? So we'll engage with the budget, with the PBO further on these matters. And I think there's questions on talk about fiscal dividend or digitalization.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, thank you, DG. I think I agree. I think we must continue this engagement with the PBO specifically on this fiscal multipliers and the implications of wider deficits in this environment. I think to respond directly to the fiscal cliff issue, I think that is the difficulty here, is that despite what's being proposed and as the PBO has pointed out, the risks associated with the proposals, we don't have a stabilizing debt outlook, and we continue to see debt service costs rising at almost double the rate, nominal rate of other areas of spending. And it is a major concern, because ultimately poorly managed public finances, typically in terms of composition of spend, you'll find a government typically spending its money only on wages and debt service costs. And you can see that in many countries around the world that have not adequately closed their deficit and not adequately controlled consumption spend. So it is a big concern, the deterioration, and that is what the Budget 2020 tries to do. And this is, I think, also, Chair, one of the complexities of budgeting, is that there's a level of spend which is substantial, and then there's the changes at the margin that we're trying to make. And this difference between levels and changes is can be confusing and is often quite complex. we're going to spend ₹1.84 trillion this year as government, rising to about ₹2.2 trillion over the next 3 years, and a level of spending that is, by historic, in historic terms, one of the highest that we have on record. So in that sense, the government is spending a lot, and as a share of GDP, spending more than has historically been the case. On the margin, we're saying we want to change away from consumption to investment. So we have this tension in the budget, which is reductions to some baselines, reductions to the growth rate of the wage bill. And we are very candid. We say that, of course, will have implications. But we are trying to think about the longer-term outlook and the structural implications of allowing debt service costs and wages to grow faster than all the other areas of spending. And so with this budget, again, is balancing that. We're saying let's grow compensation below CPI, and let's grow goods and services and capital above CPI. And over time, your composition of spend moves away from consumption and towards capital. But it's clear, as the Fiscal Cliff Group has pointed out, that this budget on its own doesn't solve all our issues. There are many other major structural reforms that are required.
Thanks. Just on the two tax questions, on the digital taxation of the digital economy, we have a colleague, Yanga Mputa, who sits on the steering group of the Inclusive Framework, actually. So she's plays a prominent role at the OECD on these discussions. Our approach has been we are really looking for the OECD to provide a consensus agreement amongst all companies on how you tackle this global taxation issue. We've seen France came forward with some unilateral measures, the US then threatened tariffs, the UK came forward with unilateral measures, and then the US threatened tariffs again. So it's getting a little bit messy on the international front on this tax. Our approach is we really are trying to push for a consensus where all countries can work together in order to get additional revenues from this. If there is no consensus, then obviously we would need to look in a similar fashion like other countries at potential options of what unilateral measure we can do. I mean, just on this digital economy, we have introduced a VAT on digital services, and we expanded that base quite dramatically last year. So we're getting in quite a bit more revenue on value-added tax on digital services. So we are tackling it to some extent in that way. And on the corporate income tax side, completely agree with you. What we are hoping for is that by removing some of the incentives, by removing some of the exemptions, we actually increase the effective tax rate on corporates so that it can get closer to the statutory tax rate. The World Bank have also done quite an interesting piece of research which shows that the effective tax rate is very variable between different sectors within the economy. And I mean, ideally we would like to try and get them closer together so that you aren't providing implicit subsidies to one sector or the other from a tax perspective. And then we can actually increase that effective tax rate. So a lot of it's to do with the accelerated depreciation allowances, which we haven't mentioned in the budget, but it is something we're looking at, and we're looking at the other incentives and how those have an impact there. So we're very much in agreement with you on that point. Thanks.
Chair, maybe just to add one point, which is that the reductions on spending are reductions against a previously forecast baseline, and that those previous forecasts were based on what we now know to be over-optimistic estimates of potential GDP and how quickly the economy would recover. And I think that is sometimes lost. So when we talk reductions, it's reductions against a higher previous estimate of how much the economy could afford to spend. It's not a nominal reduction. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just an observation on that I think is sometimes lost in the discussion on sort of what the deterioration of the fiscal matrices actually mean for growth and sort of the reverse feedback loop. So I think it's clear that going forward, a reduction in consumption, in government consumption, sort of mathematically reduces domestic expenditure or demand. what I think is important is to understand that when the fiscal matrices slip, there is a cost that it puts on, one, the sovereign cost of borrowing through, for instance, the risk premium, which estimates sort of how South Africa is perceived to be risky in relation to, say, to other countries. And that increases the cost of borrowing, making it more expensive for us to service our debt, creating even more of a fiscal problem in and of itself. The other thing is that there's also a confidence mechanism in there. It says, for firms, for individuals, does it make sense to invest your money in an economy where you're not clear on what the fiscal outlook is going to be, whether or not the fiscal situation is sustainable, and that has implications as well for how quickly your economy is expanding, how much is being invested, and what it means for the potential of your economy's growth.
Thanks, Treasurer. Members of Parliament, clarity seeking questions, comments. Honorable Jan Du, Dutoy, Lesai, Okam.
It's not great, man. You will cover me today.
Or either.
I have my
chance there. Ok. Raida. Abrams. Are you raising my Mabilis? Ok. Mabilis. Then the chairperson will come before we close. Honorable Jan.
Honorable chairperson. Members, thank you very much. Chair, as this platform is a platform in terms of the responses of the National Treasury to the public hearings, from an oversight perspective as a member of this committee, I want to make two comments on the procurement. To be specific, DG, in terms of legitimate procurement to make it easier, understanding the current situation in terms of the red tapes, and one would want to see as when we meet next time or to have a proposal as to how this procurement can be made easier to ensure service delivery, because I think it's where we are hampering in terms of service delivery. So if one can address that to be legitimate, and also taking in consideration the corruption and safeguarding the process, I understand that very well, but how do we make this easier for procurement, for service delivery, to fast-track service delivery? The second one is that on the other cost control. Here also, Chair, is in terms of is saying that over the coming year, which is a commitment and also to ensure accountability, that over the next year, that one would want to see more detail. And it has to be specific where this cost cuttings can be done to ensure that things are being done differently. I think, Chair, in terms of my observations, thank you very much.
Thanks, Honorable Njanto. Honorable Tito.
Thank you, Chair. Gentlemen, thank you. And thank you for the presentation. I want to know, with regards to the expected Moody's downgrade that most people are speculating about at this stage. Was that taken into consideration when this budget was compiled and the effects that that would have on the economy? Secondly, the previous session that we had, we mentioned the effect of the coronavirus on a global basis, but did we take into consideration what effect that will have on the South African economy? Possible job losses, schools being closed, industries and all that. I saw this morning that one school has already been closed in in Joburg area, if I'm not mistaken. And what how would that contribute to the current challenges that we already have in the budget? And then with regards to the, you mentioned the ticket prices for airplanes and government that needs to save on that side, we must definitely have a look at the prices that we pay through the travel agent that's currently in service of Parliament. I've learned that the prices are escalated 2 to 3 times of what it's supposed to be. If we could maybe have get proof of that. Thank you.
Thanks, Honourable Ntoyi. Honourable Mletsa.
Thank you, Chair. Let me join the colleagues by appreciating the presentation. I'm sure all the efforts that are done here, the idea is to try to boost or correct the ailing economy of this country. There's a contributions of about slowing the wage bill, boosting the investment, supporting the small businesses, cutting the cost of the ministers, and so forth. But the truth remains that the corruption is really playing a vital role. Our SOEs, they are in a very bad state as we speak. The Auditor General's report exposed corruption. And what is very painful is that you will find that the innocent, loyal citizens of this country, they find themselves carrying the burden caused by the corruption. So my expectation from the Treasury today when they were responding, I thought it will be, they will talk seriously in depth about the corruption that is taking place in this country. They will be saying that we have decided to have teeth and they are going to bite. I thought that they will take the citizens of this country into confidence to say, we have been talking and talking and talking. Nothing is happening. They are not correcting themselves. This is the action that is going to be implemented in order to root out the corruption. So I still expect that maybe when they come next time, they will come up and say, we don't want to talk anymore. We've been talking, we've been sitting around the tables and talking about the corruption that is taking place here. But we don't see any action. We are always told that no, investigations are taking place. But we don't see any action happening to anyone to say that these ones have been arrested and the millions or billions that they have stolen, they've been recouped and then they are back into the coffers of the state. Thank you.
Thanks, Honourable Ryder.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chair, before I get on to the discussion, I'd just like to maybe make a point that I think that the way that we're doing these public consultations, maybe if I can request that we need to have a look at how we're doing it, because I think that the time afforded for the consultations earlier on this week was extremely limited, and I know that certain players abused the opportunity and overran their time, and thus limiting for people that came after them. Now, noting the list that we have on page 2, you know, I do note it's a lot of the syntax targets that are the ones that are shouting the most, and I suppose it's a sign of moral regeneration, but the list of sinners is increasing, and we can expect to have more and more people presenting to us as a committee going forward, and I'd therefore maybe like to request that we afford more time to these inputs if possible going forward, just to give people a fair hearing. And I think that the fact that they do expend their time and energy in coming to Parliament to present to us, we need to acknowledge that. And so, yes, I'd like to thank the people that did take the time to engage with the budget and come and give us their thoughts. Yeah, and again, before I get on to the presentations, I want to disagree strongly with Mr. Mohammed from the PBO I think Ms. Modisa and Ian have largely covered what I wanted to say in response, but you can't borrow yourself out of debt. I think that principle is well established. If you don't believe it, come look at my bank account. Good. Getting on to the presentation, DG and your team, I think you've done an exceptional job addressing the key issues that have come up, and the manner in which you've answered them has been excellent. I also want to appreciate the change in tone that we experienced today and from some previous engagements, and so I appreciate the fact that there is definitely a more consultative approach from Treasury and a willingness to engage. I want to. Is there someone here from Kusatu today, Chair? I don't believe so. I'm a little disappointed with that, because that was obviously that's a key focus of the inputs that we've had and of the comments that have been going backwards and forwards. And it's a little bit disingenuous to have given a presentation earlier this week on Wednesday. And not come back for the response. Now, that seems to be becoming a hallmark, but I think that the responses that Treasury has given are extremely valid, and perhaps to underline them, the fact that the three-year agreement was made in a very different environment from where we find ourselves in today. It was also made by a different executive as well, and an executive that has been largely discredited through processes like the Zondo Commission. And the unions need to remember that their role is to prevent exploitation. And I fully support that. I don't believe any worker should be exploited. But by the same token, I don't believe that the South African taxpayer should be exploited. And so with the changed environment, with the different facts that we find ourselves with today, trying to enforce a three-year-old agreement, I think, is perhaps a little bit cheeky on the one side, and then to throw your stones out and then not come back for the response, I think, is really it's disingenuous in the extreme. Aside from that, I specifically, Chris, I think some of your inputs I wanted to touch on. Yeah, I think you made the point. Debt to GDP is not under control. And Ian also spent some time on this. The 6.8% deficit that we're facing is based on best-case scenario planning almost. So I think that the burgeoning public debt is very likely to be even more than we think it is. And so I was just wondering, what is the plan B? So if we find ourselves not making the growth figures that we've projected, if we find ourselves not managing to reduce the wage bill as much as we wanted in year one, is there a plan B? I suppose we've always got the medium-term budget policy statement. But that's going to be a good number of months away, and I think we need a short-term response as much as we need a medium and long-term. I'm aware that Outa was one of the presenters on Wednesday that had time constraints, and one of the issues I see hasn't been responded to, perhaps wasn't mentioned on Wednesday, but it is some clarity on the e-tolls issue. I know that we are talking about different sources of income, etc. This is one that is largely failing, and I was wondering if there is any clarity on that. We have been promised answers. If you can maybe fill me in on that. You spoke about removing exemptions and incentives, or reviewing and with a view to removing. To put it in context, now my request is just for reasonable transparency in this regard, and I do understand that often when you remove an exemption, there is a time factor to it, and the fact is it needs to be a bit of a surprise so that, you know, the abuse of exemptions is not doesn't happen. But I'm just requesting reasonable transparency on that. I wanted to welcome your comment on the workshop and say that I do think, I think you've heard it from me before, consultation is key. And then I want to talk about the single-use plastic tax, which is strongly welcomed, and perhaps a note to the chair, maybe we can start in Parliament by setting an example. I don't know why we've gone from plates to using these awful things that you find on beaches around the country, but perhaps we can pressure our parliamentary support staff to go back to the old-fashioned plates so that we're not putting single-use plastic into the environment. We can start setting an example. Chair, those are my inputs. Thank you.
Thanks, Brida. Abrams.
Yes, Chair. Thank you so much for the opportunity, and thanks to Treasury for coming up with the responses. Unfortunately, my opening remark will be to agree with Honourable Raiden, because we had inputs and the chairperson duly invited the stakeholders to this meeting, and it would have been really helpful for them to be part of this meeting. And in the same tone of voice, I wish to really appreciate the stakeholders that are here. Because I think, Chair, the way things have been explained by Treasury, by and large, makes sense to almost all the questions that we received from the stakeholders on the day. I'm especially happy with the issue and how they deal with the issue of wage bill. However, Chair, I do have some questions. For example, as to what is happening at NEDLAC, because I think the stakeholders, some of the stakeholders that were there, we're going back and forth. I would appreciate it if we could hear it from Treasury. The good thing about what was said in the public hearing was also the role of the private sector in assisting with the budget of the country in fighting issues of unemployment, poverty and inequality. And I think such measures would really assist to our economy. Chair, there was a stakeholder that had an issue with the cigarette tax going down gradually. And I thought maybe the Treasury would comment on that. And generally, whether as Treasury or government, we do have the capacity to monitor what we give out to the various departments. There were quite a few examples that were cited, for example, around what is happening in the education department. And by and large, in all departments, if you look at how government is charged by service providers, seems to be so exorbitant that the funds allocated to various votes end up not doing what they were supposed to do in the different votes. Chair, I think the professor from Fiscal Cliff Study Group is here, and I guess he is also satisfied somehow with the explanation that has been given. However, can Treasury give us some confirmation of how best going forward are we going to deal with the issue of the communication of the budget? Because sometimes we are not Treasury, we oversight Treasury, but we have a view as some members of the committee, that Treasury is doing their best to walk the tightrope. That is our view, maybe as the majority party. But some in the Fiscal Cliff Study Group seem to think that the taxpayers are being disrespected by Treasury, you know? And based on that, I would love a situation where Treasury could just take us through a process going forward that would see to it that the stakeholders are taken on board. I know that to a certain extent you are not going to agree with everybody, but the rationale behind the moves, the principles, need to be understood, except for some who are not interested in building the nation and therefore growth in the economy. Thanks, Chairman.
Who's the next? The chairperson is going to lead this. Are you the final? Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Treasury DG, thank you for your response. I think I do agree with the honorables who are saying the stakeholders should have been present. I mean, they have asked questions sharply, and you could see that they have researched very well. So it was going to be an interest or interesting if they've got follow-up questions for you. Now they are not here, we don't even know if they are satisfied. The other question was about teacher people ratio, nurse, you know, something like that. But you have answered all that correctly. And my interest now today is about this one about the procurement as well, because I know it will just keep on coming. It is also linked to a whole lot of things, corruption. So the draft public procurement bill has been gazetted. If perhaps, you know, the public can know, you know, so that they're notified, everybody might just go there and comment. Perhaps, you know, things will be, everybody will be given a chance just to comment there. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just a correction. That school is Hilton in KZN, not in Joburg.
I just want to say a few quick things. One is, maybe it's difficult to say, but
I mean, the coronavirus is going to impact on the global economic growth forecast. And is it going to have any significant impact on South Africa? Secondly, the budget may not be an austerity budget. Even if you say it's not an austerity budget, it's certainly very austere. I think that the views expressed by the PBO or Saraj are credible views. They're not particularly Marxist even. They could be Keynesian. They could be social democrat. In fact, there are people in the DA, if I understand its broad spectrum of thinking, the more, let's say, social democratic sorts in the DA would be empathetic with it. So it's not something outlandish. As you as DG will know, you may disagree with it, but the way Mr. Ryder is presenting it, I don't agree. He's presenting like some sort of extreme left view or something. That's not my understanding. On the issue of people not being here, it was we who introduced this thing. It never happened from 1994. It was first introduced in the 2014 year, I think, or 2015. It was never done before to deal with community or public participation, as you all know. Much to the irritation, frankly, of Treasury, because at this time of the year, they get 1,000 different commitments. They have to engage with all sorts of stakeholders, including the investment fund managers and the rating agencies. So when we first suggested they come back, they did raise with us practical problems, and we've put our foot down. So no other committee does this, actually. It's just these committees that do it, where you have a public hearing. People can present written or oral submissions. And then what happens is we say to Treasury, you come back, and you answer to them. Never mind that you come here on the Thursday after the Wednesday of the budget. So they come. They reply. Then the people who made public submissions are given a chance to reply. Then we ask Treasury to reply.
hell, man, I don't know which parliament, show me in the world, does this, right? And then we throw it open to the MPs. I jumped the gun with my comrade chair, whereas what about the chairperson? I mean, what about the committee members? And he reminded me, actually, Treasurer must reply. I don't know how much further we can go. Now, as for Kosatu not being here, I think it's unfortunate. But my own view is it can't be disingenuous. In other words, Kosatu has got a limited number of people, and they deal in their parliamentary budget, or their own parliamentary, what is called liaison office. If I'm correct, there's just two people there. We deal with 34 committees or something. I don't know how many committees, 28 committees and so on. So basically, I really don't agree. And we're not going to agree. I have a right to reply. And Mr. Ryder and I can disagree. I don't agree it's disingenuous at all. What I do agree is that they should have come, ideally, because they're a big stakeholder. But we also know that this very day, they're involved in other negotiations around issues related to the economy and the budget. I also think it's more appropriate for Treasury, for Kosatu to come when the appropriations matters have been dealt with. Because while it's true that the reduction or managing the wage bill over the next 3 years is a crucial feature of the budget as a whole, it is primarily an appropriations issue. Then I want to say that it's all very well for us to say, you know what, Kosatu shouldn't be fighting this old battle. We can disagree on that. Even within the ANC, we won't agree. And there's no formal position by the study group. And I don't think we should have a long debate here. But we should agree with a broad movement. Within the ANC, will not agree on how we manage this process. And I don't think we should take positions that are not those of the study groups, which haven't met to discuss the study group position. But what I should say is that it seems to me reasonable for me to say that it doesn't gel well out there with poor people and working people in the public sector in particular if we are not tightening our own belts. So it would be nice if MPs, in my view, Comrade Chair, said, Kosatu should do this and we should do this. Now the one thing that's been done for us, we didn't do, is the no increases, right? The minister announced it. Presumably none of us is going to challenge this. Certainly I don't think the ANC will agree that an individual MP can stand up and say, hey, I want my increase. That's unlikely to happen, but the two chairs, particularly the chair of the NA, who's the chair of the study group and the whip, will attend to that matter. But we should also, I think people, it's very rich for us to say, cut those, you know, reduce the wage bill over the next 3 years. What are we doing as MPs to cut costs? We might well want to deal with the things at the same time, so our credibility is higher than making others pay the cost of what, finally, are our collective failures. Yes, the majority party must take its fair share, but it's all of us, this parliament. The people voted in a parliament of 400 here and 60 in the, well, not a problem, you know how it works, right? Let me not bore you. Now, on the Competition Commission decisions, I don't really understand what you said, DJ, and what's there. What do you mean the Competition Commission decisions on retail and telecoms? I think I know the telecoms one. What's the retail one? Then on the car issue, now, the professor is here. You see, it's not about the professor. It's about these two committees. For 3 years, we've been badgering the presidency to reply to his very legitimate question. Why can we not encourage, through the presidency, ministers, deputy ministers, and later down the road, MECs and mayors and so on, to buy cars that are manufactured or assembled in this country? Chairperson will recall it came up in the last budget too. Now, I have spoken to the ministers, the president's parliamentary councillor. The last time we engaged, he said that, leave it to me. And when I spoke to him fleetingly recently, he said he's got two ministers attending to this matter. Can I take it in our report once again, because it's our, Chairperson, it's us. Parliament decided that we agree with Professor Rousseau. So it's not his issue alone. It's our issue. It's ridiculous of the presidency, which is not above Parliament, not to reply. So, DG, we are urging you. I will send the correspondence. Alan's got all the correspondence. Send it to me, Alan. I'll go through it. I'll show it to the co-chair. He's familiar with it. We sent it to him last year. We're sending it to you now. Please, your minister and you probably will agree, right? I mean, your minister will probably say, not only must they get cars assembled in this country, Toyota and whatever, not because I'm a Toyota fan, but you know, whatever they are, they can choose. It's also because he'll probably say, hey, make it a ceiling of 20,000 rands per car. The rest of the ministers must pay, right? So I know one thing, this is the one thing the minister and I will agree, personally, not as an ANC chairperson, as a, you know, a person in my own right as an activist. I only became a chair in 1998. I've been an activist since 1971. So this is just a title. This doesn't define my character and my ideology. I am what I am, and I'm unapologetic about it. And those who appoint me, they know who I am. I don't hide it. And they appoint me still, even to chair the finance committee on that side. That's not my problem. I just do my job. So, I mean, what I'm trying to say is I and the minister for once will agree, right, on the car story. Now, this thing, what's this thing about implicit subsidization of road freight? I think I understand it, DG, but I'm not sure that I do. And can I once again repeat? I hear what your colleague there is saying, so predictable, but I'm glad you haven't got a VAT increase, and I hope it doesn't happen. And yes, some of us will be guided by the majority, but personally, some of us, you know, will be very uneasy about it. Finally, I want to plead that members appreciate, and I can't force you to, it's just my view, that, see, Treasury comes here with a lot of proposals, but they themselves can't implement them. They're like, if you're like a coordinating department in this sense. So we can't hold them to account if departments are, you know, spending recklessly and so on. They can do their bit, but we will say, who are you? You're just another department. So, DG, once again we come back to this. Half the things you'll know, you've been around for thousands of years, as young as you look, right? Actually, we've said for how many years? Thousands, I've been longer here than you are, right? Thousands of years. The issue really is, when are we going to implement? When? And we can't hold you to account because many of these things, Comrade Chair, fall under other departments. So, for example, on energy issues. You know, I mean, I hope the Committee on Energy will see our report. They must move on those things that they said they're going to do. And so on and so on. Thank you, sir.
Comrade.
Comrade. Sorry. You can be, sir, Comrade, if you like.
The chair is in a fighting mood.
No, I'm just being myself.
Thanks, Chairperson. Did you respond?
No, thank you very much, Chair. We welcome the questions and the comments from members. Thank you very much.
Certainly, you've been
2,000 years. At least I've been 1,000 years. Yes, you know where I think it's important that we get guidance. The issue, and I think I'm starting at the last point, that it's important that we pin accountability to where it belongs. Sometimes it's very, and sometimes people think Treasury can just. There's only 1,100 of us. Technical staff, you find another, say, 700, 800 or so. And then there's only about 120 staff who deal with province and municipalities, and about 50-plus who deal with national departments. So what happens in the Department of Education in Mpumalanga, Eastern Cape, is sometimes a bit far from us to understand the nitty-gritty of what's happening there. So you find that half the time you have to rely on what the Treasury there says. And by the way, the PFMA and the MFMA places certain responsibilities on ourselves and the PFMA, I mean the provincial treasuries, and essentially the accounting officers. So sometimes that relationship, and you know, and when sometimes we engage, then it's like we're overstepping our mandate. And then we argue that the Constitution gives us certain powers. We use that when it's relevant and necessary. And that goes to how then we're trying to coordinate. And we say the statement as you present is a statement of government, not a statement of the Treasury. But the minister rises up in Parliament and saying, because we try as much as we can, then that's always a difficult thing that we have been perfecting over a number of years that I've been around, whereby you orientate the issues in the economic cluster with the economic DG, cluster DGs, and because Treasury is a member of almost all the clusters. We then have to orientate issues in all the clusters. Then they become cabinet. Then they become extended cabinet where provinces are involved, and the PPCC, the President Coordinating Council, and then is then taken forward. And most of the time, then the budget process articulates what essentially was a eight-month process. So sometimes it's not properly coordinated, and in that we then are then saying things in the budget, and you find that we have then have to push departments to implement or own up and something like that. So that balance is always difficult, but that's the principle that we're playing a coordinating role. Now, going to the issue around consultation broadly, we recognized that over some time ago, and we welcomed this. Initially, as you said, Chair, we used to have issues coming here, and certainly in my case, since I became DG in 2017, these are things the second hearing that I'm part, because this week would normally be in an international roadshow, explaining the budget, talking to, engaging with bondholders and rating agencies, trying to explain the rationale and win their faith and their commitment to buying our bonds, to buying our treasury bonds, because that's how we finance our operations, as you know. So we've done local roadshows last week in Cape Town. We did yesterday. We finished the last set of investor roadshows in Johannesburg. So we engage all the difficult issues that we were asked here and in the hearings. Rating agencies, including investors, various investors are questioning these. So these are very detailed discussions from 7 in the morning to like 4:30 in the afternoon, every hour engaged. So then we divide ourselves. Coronavirus, the challenge, and Bupuso will talk there about that in terms of how, as they were modeling some of the thinking, and to what extent did we take into account some of these things. There are two critical meetings happening today. As you said, we have to spread ourselves wide. We wrote, as early on, as much as we started interacting with the issue this weekend, at least on Monday or over the weekend, the minister then, obviously with the president, saw a need for us to really engage with the Reserve Bank, at least at a macro subcommittee level, because there are various committees between ourselves and the Reserve Bank. The technical teams met yesterday, the governor and the minister meeting this afternoon, and a whole lot of teams, to just get into the details of, one, the impact of the recession, the impact of coronavirus, and what kind of responses should we be putting together as a package, noting what you just said a week ago in the budget. And at the same level, I can imagine in the President's Economic Advisory Council meeting that took place from this morning, the President with his Economic Advisory Council are meeting, and one can expect that these issues will be discussed. So one expects in these two engagements and what we have put in together, we'll come up with some responses that we'll try to attempt and communicate that, because that's important in terms of work that we do on an ongoing basis. Just in terms of communication at this level, as much as the Chair said, we started recently in 2014. After that, what we realized, communicating and engaging with civil society becomes important, and extending what essentially is this week into engagements that have to span throughout the year. We have got, 2 years ago, we instituted a website called vulekamali.gov.za, where it's a tool where we put all data that's at our disposal, just so that South Africans who are interested in this area can access data and engage us. Even around the budget, we've got various forum engagements where we engage. But I think all we need to do is to actually enhance and speed that up in the way that we involve South Africans, knowing very well that the law obviously gives the Minister of Finance certain powers and the Treasurer certain powers in crafting a budget, but how consultative it should be should remain an issue, and we have to continue making sure that we consult and we engage, we hear more views, because we don't think our view is the ultimate view on some of these matters. The procurement bill is there, and yes, I think we will definitely have to make known that it's there, and then beef up our engagement with society, because it's a very critical area in that's where the corruption, that's where the issues are, especially around supply chain, that's where these matters are become kind of in your face. Treasury's role and what we should be doing, I think, is a collective effort from ourselves, yes, in terms of what the law and the opportunity that the law gives us, vis-a-vis exactly the point I mentioned earlier around the accounting officers and the various oversight committees in provinces, various oversight committees in municipalities. So it then becomes a collective effort that when issues are identified at a municipality or a provincial department, that they are dealt with at source. Where we are, sometimes we only know about the issue when it's already a year later through the, for instance, through the AG in some instances where there's a fruitless and wasteful or unauthorized expenditure we have to deal with, or when there are allegations and there are forensic investigations that are happening. And we can only do that to a point. But there's then your big ticket items, things that came through over the years, and there were many lessons that I think we learned from the whole State Capture Commission and the issues that are coming up there, and what kind of approvals do we as Treasury give, what kind of deviation requests do we agree to, and that what kind of extensions do we do. And as an accounting officer, I can tell you in the Treasury, for instance, you'll find that there's a tender that is coming to an end, that was awarded for, or it could be on anything, say some IT equipment in the assets and liability management, some back office sort of software that we've been using to manage our cash flow as a country. And you find that it's a 3-year contract or a 5, whatever year, and then it's coming to an end, and you find that maybe a month before you get a note that says we request that it's extended. You find that you don't have a choice, you're not going on tender, because if you don't extend this, then the system collapses, and the whole cash management system of government gets messed up. And then the question then becomes, do you not extend or do you extend, and the implications thereof. So, but however, it's important, that talks to contract management, that there are people who should actually be knowing what contracts are coming to an end and when, how do we synchronize those things. And then it then becomes a function of the efficiency and effectiveness of the internal audit functions in the department, the impact, the efficiency of the CFO and then the corporate services director, DDG, and myself and my office, and how I interact as an accounting officer with what's happening in my backyard in the department. Now, where we are seated, if there are signs of where there's manipulation of these things, we should be able to detect these things, and how treasuries and budget analysts in treasuries are able to position themselves to work closely with CFOs becomes an issue. And I think the point that I think is made around how exactly we are dealing with this, we should up our game in terms of ensuring that we address corruption at source, address corruption tendencies that may be, then deal with them appropriately, and then expect that state-owned companies, public entities, and other government departments also have got robust processes in place that deals with such measures if they have to happen at any given point in time. What is happening at NEDLAC? Look, there are many things at NEDLAC, but I can tell you insofar as this area at hand on the wage bill front, as you would know, we would have a post-budget engagement with NEDLAC every Friday after the budget. After Thursday, engage with joint committees, all of us rush to the airport because at 9 o'clock we have to be at NEDLAC on Friday. Engage with NEDLAC. As you can imagine, we presented at NEDLAC the same presentation that you interacted with last week with the joint committees. And the focus was obviously on wage bill. As we presented, we focused on that because that would have been an issue. But at NEDLAC, what happened on this matter was that we recognized, we know, thank you very much, and coming from all the partners, especially your labor in this case, this issue is an issue of the bargaining council, because we are simply putting on the table and saying, can we open up engagements on year one, the last year of the previous agreement, because of the challenges that we have, the situation, and someone said, the environment is totally different from where we was when you entered. So it's a PSCBC process, and I think, so we left NEDLAC on this matter, left the matter as at that, and then we did not obviously engage any further. The role of the private sector in ensuring that they play their role in fulfilling employment, poverty, and inequality, that's critical, and we've said it. Private sector, over and above the role of the state, the private sector has a huge role to play, but however, it's important that we continue to have a private sector which is responsive and acknowledge the challenges, our own challenges as a country, including the impact of the apartheid leaders. That we should continue saying, and unapologetically so, because they obviously have a role to play in terms of ensuring that inequality and poverty and unemployment is addressed one or the other. Chris will talk about the cigarette tax. Our capacity to motivate what's happening at education department. As I said, the point, this answer is the same point that, we know what's happening, the class pupil ratio, it also becomes an education department issue. We will provide resources in terms of allocations of money for compensation, allocation of money for goods, for learner support material. And there are norms and standards, whether it's 1 to 32 or 1 to 36, there are norms. Now, if the class pupil ratio is 1 and to 50 in some of your rural schools, then if the pit latrine is still there, out there in some of the areas, and that's the challenge, then the efficiency of the spend in the Department of Education becomes here. Then we don't expect that the Portfolio Committee on Education, one expects that the Department of Education, the DG of Education, the head of department in any particular province should account. Say, you've given resources, appropriation committee, appropriated money, equitable share appropriations in the province, what is happening, and then the DG or the head of department, together with his team, must then account in terms of, but what we then do on a quarterly basis, by the way, our teams from both public finance division in where Dr. Mampomudisi sits over national departments and where Mary Jane's team in province and municipalities, there's that engagement with provinces in terms of their budget spends. The Section 32 and Section 32 reports in terms of monthly spend, we view and we actually question some of the, if there's slow spending in other areas, we continue playing our oversight role. But the getting to the bottom of the real issues around some small school in Limpopo and why it was not, then it becomes necessarily really a district matter, including a provincial education department matter. But when we are aware, and whichever way it comes to us, we definitely intervene. Like, for instance, some company phoned me yesterday afternoon and say, for the past 5 months, the Department of Eastern Cape is owing them $280 million. Please, we've been talking there to everybody, no assistance. So what we do then, normally sometimes we just get the department, make the treasury aware, we write to them and say, sometimes it helps, but at the end of the day, it's the head of Department of Education in that province who should ensure that they pay within 30 days. It's not a national treasury problem. It's a problem that must be addressed first and foremost by the department and the accounting officer responsible. There's also then an issue about, what is Plan B? What is Plan B if the wage bill, Plan B is a collective. It's a problem of the collective here. We've got three options. One is, do we go further and cut the budget, slice them up, and then obviously we will engage the, and the issues that the PBO are raising become stuck in the reality that we have to deal with. Either we do that, we take money from this one in order to plug the gap that would have been created by, it's actually a 37, 38 billion rand problem in year one. Of this 160 billion. Option number two is, do we increase taxes? I'll look to my right. Do we go to VAT? It's not going to be an, it's a no. That's why we didn't go there, because of the impact. Do we increase other taxes? Maybe a no, as Chris explained earlier. The last question then, do we go out into these investors and get more debt? So we are stuck. We can only do it in three ways. And then the question is becomes then, is 6.8 the number? Think about it. 4.2 deficit in year 2019-20 to 6.8. That difference and the impact of that and how we are viewed as a country. Some people say debt to GDP, as I said last week to the committee, debt to GDP by Japan and the US is more than 100-200%. Why don't we go there, South Africa? What stops us? But there are certain fundamentals that are not in place, our savings level, performance of the economy, interest rate level, that will make it almost impossible and difficult to go to increase this 68 debt to GDP to 70 or even to 80. So these are choices that we'll have to make. That's why the appeal is not an appeal to to say we are balancing the figures and the numbers. I think the point that was made that the environment has completely changed. The environment, that the impact that you're going to see with corona is going to be completely change the face of what's happening. I'm not scaremongering here, but if Hilton is going to be closed down, I met a friend of mine this morning for coffee, breakfast, who is from Hilton in KZN. He cannot go home. He's stuck here. He's stuck because, he's afraid to go in and so on. Now imagine if Hilton was where I come from in Brest, and you've got the whole Roslyn Brest area where the automotive sector is located. Firestone, auto cable, all those factories that supply the industry in Roslyn. If you have to close that off, it means your production, motor vehicle production, is going to be affected. So the impact is still going to be seen, and how do we balance that off later is going to be an issue. So I'm just mentioning this because these are critical things that we have to engage with as we move forward. Consult the cost, and I'm not being nasty, Chair, and I'm using the example because you also mentioned it. Parliament and the way Parliament should begin. I just mentioned to Bipus, as I said earlier, when I was joking to her, I said, Bipus, maybe it's because I had breakfast, Bipus. I said, I'm thinking about at home, will I get crackers and all of the nice food that we had? It's not a reflection, but you're right. The point that you made is right. Because one expects that I would have had breakfast at Break Milk and Honey with my friend from Hilton, come here and I can only have a cup of coffee. We move on during the day. And I said, maybe our parliament can only say, lunch you'll dead, definitely. Because you're working. And you can't go out and go and Tarek and have lunch or something. And so it's the implication that the small little things that matter. And I'm just mentioning it because you mentioned that, but this was a private conversation with Wipuso earlier. It's not public, okay. And Ian and the other colleagues can take the other matters that I didn't. Impact Moody's downgrade. If Tshepiso Moatlhodi, who's the acting DDG, Assets and Liabilities, was here, she would say, when we budget, we don't take into account what Moody's is. We don't budget for Moody's or others. We budget on the fundamentals that we need to balance out. We look at our own situation. How do we actually move these things around? And then we do what we do every year. After we take photos and we all look great, nice with our ties, we go into my office with everyone. We sit and get onto the phone call with Moody's, S&P, and everyone. This year around, Moody's is here this week, so we met Moody's this week, one-on-one, Monday, Tuesday. The others, we are on the phone. We explained. They asked the rationale why we did this and why. We explained. With Moody's, the example, the indication was that we said, looking as to things that you said will actually put us in a good state for us to improve our rating, you said the following: address structural issues around changes that are needed to boost the economy, address certain things on the wage bill remains a challenge, all of those things. So we were saying to them, we are ticking the boxes. But as much as we are ticking, the economy is not doing well, debt is increasing, but we have ticked. We have ticked wages, we have ticked structural issues, we are progressing on the electricity environment, etc. So we don't budget based on what Moody's will say, but however, the impact of what we are doing, obviously, it can either be a plus for Moody's as they view us, or a negative. But we always believe our own story. I tell my team this all the time. You have to believe what you put out on the budget review, and be able to explain and defend it and argue and explain the rationale. I think from my side, we have dealt, unless if colleagues can pick up other areas that were not, that I didn't talk to. Do you want to come in?
Thank you, DG. So just to respond to a couple of questions posed, Chair. The first was on whether or not the forecast has taken into consideration the impact of a potential downgrade and what we think, or what our view is on the coronavirus and its impact. So I think the DG has summarized it correctly in saying that our forecast is policy neutral. That means we don't build anything into the forecast that hasn't happened yet. But what we do do is provide scenarios that try to indicate what we think could happen if certain risks materialize to the forecast that we explain and have put to the book in Chapter 2. So with regard to the first scenario, which would be a Moody's downgrade, we haven't forecast one into the baseline. But what we have done is given a scenario that suggests what we think would happen to growth if we were to see some of the elements that might be associated with a downgrade coming to fruition. So what would happen if we were to see a significantly increased cost of borrowing, a significant slippage in the exchange rate, a significant stagnation in growth and what that might mean collectively. But what we've also done is overlay that with the second component of the question, which is around the coronavirus. So I will answer it in two parts. Firstly, just giving a sense of what we think might happen globally, what the risks are, and then what we've presented in the scenario. So on the coronavirus, it's too soon to say what exactly it's going to mean for the South African economy, but what we're clear on is that it poses a significant downside risk. At the moment, what we know is that the IMF has indicated that it could potentially decrease its global outlook for growth by 0.1 percentage points this year. The OECD has decreased by a half a percentage point to global growth because of the uncertainty that it poses. But there's still a fair amount of variation, and the IMF has explicitly stated that it is currently exploring more severe scenarios of what the virus's impact might be on growth. How we approach it is the elements of the forecast that inform global growth come from the IMF. We wait for that point estimate. We're currently assessing by looking at high frequency data to get a sense of where it's going to look. We're clear that it's going to be a downside risk, but what we do know, given what's available from a data perspective, is that global PMIs have come down. This year we know that Chinese PMI has hit historical low levels in February. We also know that manufacturing output globally was the lowest that it's been since February, since 2009 in February of this year. So collectively, this means for us we've got significant risks on the external, on our view on the external environment support to growth. And if you'd look at the assumptions that we presented in Chapter 2, we had said there that we were looking at a more optimistic and more supportive global environment, and this is becoming significantly more risky as we see the impact of the coronavirus taking hold. So we're waiting to see what the IMF's view is going to be and what that's going to mean for our forecast. Once we have that hard data, we will then be able to incorporate that. That will happen in early February. In terms of the direct cost on the South African economy, it's unclear what that's going to be. Purely from a response perspective, how much is it going to mean for education, how much is it going to mean for healthcare, how many days off, we don't know. And that would have to be informed by what the policy response is to the virus domestically. And I guess we'll know that as time unfolds. But it's clear that it's going to be a material downside risk to the forecast. What I would want to say then is the collective impact of what we think might happen if you were to see some of the elements of a downgrade and what we think would happen if we were to start taking into consideration a far less supportive global growth environment would be, currently the forecasts presented is for 0.9% growth in year, 1.3% next year, 1.6% in 2022. The combined effects of these impacts would see a contraction of growth in 2020 of 0.5%, going to see only growth of 1% in 2022. So a significant downward revision to the forecast in the event that these risks do materialize as presented in the scenario. So these are the things that we're considering, and that's how we've incorporated them into our analysis. Chair, you had asked a question on the Competition Commission's involvement in the retail space. So effectively what we're referring to there is the Competition Commission's recommendations last year to end exclusive leases in retail spaces. So effectively what that would do would be to open up competition in retail spaces and gain some of those efficiencies as well.
Thanks. Okay, I'll be very, very quick. There was just a question on the, we didn't talk enough about the excise duties on cigarettes. There were some commentators saying that it had gone down. I you know, so we don't think it's gone down. It was 2 years, 3 years ago, it was above a rand increase. Last year, it was above a rand increase. This year, the increase was 74 cents. So the increase was a lot lower than the previous years. But that's also linked with the fact that inflation, for us, expected inflation has come down quite a lot. So there is still an increase. It is still above the targeted excise burden. I think if there needs to be a large, substantial increase to go far above the burden, we would need to do a review of what tobacco excise duties and what we're trying to achieve with that policy, which we are thinking about internally. Thank you.
Done, except just one last question. The chair asked the implicit subsidization of red flight should cease. I think that was the question. I think that we're saying, look, I mean, there are many benefits to actually get everyone on rail and the goods, because the impact, you know, on the road, etc. So that's a thought. Yeah, this is that.
Okay. Thanks very much, Treasurer. from here, Secretariat, working together with PBO, will have to compile a report that will discuss on Tuesday next week and adopt the report the same day. The following day, on Wednesday, the report has to be tabled in the NA for debate and adoption. So that's what the process is going to look like. So let's pick up issues, PBO and Secretariat, that are here in the budget that we have to. Let's not go into policy matters like how if a municipality buy electricity from somebody. We don't have the facts. It's like this one, this point you are afraid from road to rail. I know transport has a police. But let's not forget that there will be sectoral budget presentations. So this committee doesn't have to preempt what other departments are going to present and expatiate. So it will be on the wrong side of the law if we even begin to anticipate or preempt them and say the following should happen or should not happen. So let's stick to the fiscal framework and the challenges that are there. We can touch about, we're part of the global community. So you can't speak to yourself. So we have to say something on the overview at the beginning in regard to the global situation, national, and come to where we are. And deal with a budget that is going to speak to the people. I understand you are raising Moody's time and again, but what about the 57 million people? Because as we are seated here, people are being retrenched. There's problem of load shedding. There are so many problems. So we are not here in an economics classroom where we debate this and that concept. We must think about unemployment, inequality, and poverty. Those are the issues that affect our people. And the wage bill, I think, DG, let's get stats from in regard to SOEs. I think when we talk about the wage bill, we don't only talk about public servants in the departments. As you said, that there's a lot of leakages in SOEs. Probably we can pick one or two and sample it so that we tell the public this is what happens in regard to salary structure, poor expenditure. Because people are, the countries, the citizens are bailing out SOEs time and again, and they don't understand why. So let's talk to that with facts, not just I stand there and present a report with emotions. Let's get facts on one or two SOEs that we can sample and then present it. So are you raising a hand, Honorable Chairperson?
Chair, I'm not intending to disrupt you. I just wanted to give a DG Badkos to International Roadshow. Okay. The Badkos that I want to give you, as you go to the roadshow, please take care, be careful, and don't bring us things that we don't need. I don't know where you're going, but just be careful. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Chairperson. There's your podcast, DJ. So let's. You want to say to me?
Only practical issue should find that the chairs feel. For a few minutes, the staff putting together the report, that doesn't mean PBO, the staff putting together the report, we just meet the chairs to discuss deadlines. We give it to you on a Monday afternoon. We try our best to do so. But on the Tuesday, we'll, the main issue is the recommendation. The Tuesday, we'll go through it carefully. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks. With that comment, the meeting has come to an end and is adjourned. Let's meet on Tuesday.